All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Our first guest on the show today is Jeremiah Gulka. He writes about the politics and culture of security. Was previously an analyst at the Rand Corporation, where he was the primary author of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, a policy conundrum. He visited the MEK's Camp Ashraf in Iraq in 2007. And there's a previous interview of him about that Rand study and other things, too, if you go to scotthortonshow.com. Welcome back to the show, Jeremiah. How are you doing?
I'm good, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
Well, you're welcome. I'm very happy to have you here. I want to direct everybody's attention to this new piece in the American Prospect, prospect.org, The Cult of MEK. The Mujahideen-e-Khalq is trying to steer its supporters in the United States toward war, which shows that the enemy of our enemy is not our friend. Well, that's good. I always like some good conventional wisdom debunking, especially, you know, cliche debunking when I can get some. But here you start off with the images, which I shouldn't be surprised by stuff like this, but I really was surprised to see Newt Gingrich bowing like Obama before the Saudi king. Newt Gingrich bowing to Myram Rajavi, who's basically T of the Bow and T leaders of this Heaven's Gate cult. What in the hell was he doing bowing to her anyway? Is he a member of the cult? I knew he followed Sung Young Moon.
he, like a lot of other former officials, are receiving significant sums to give speeches on their behalf, and he was in Paris at an event that they had lots and lots of different prominent former officials and some writers to sing the praises of the MEK, and this is all organized in an effort to get the MEK off of the U.S. foreign terrorist operation list. That way they'd be able to raise even more money for their ultimate goal, which is to get themselves installed as a new government in Iran. And since they have zero support in Iran, they need someone's military to put them into power. And so that's why they're drumming up all these fears of war with Iran, so that we can put them in power at the head of our battalion.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, let's elaborate a little bit about that there. The dream that somehow we could do a 1953, drum up a regime change in Iran and place Myram Rajavi or any of the other members of the MEK cult in power in Iran. There is a what percentage chance of that?
Well, I think that's about zero. Even if you take that model, I think the more likely model they would want would be the Iraq invasion, where we would directly put them in. Because when we propped up the Shah in the 50s, he had a previous record, let's say, of being there. The fact that there was an existing monarchy, there are these pre-existing that they could tap into, whereas this would be fresh and new, and they literally have no base of support, even though they claim to be the number one opposition group. They destroyed their base of support, not just becoming a cult, but more importantly, because the last time they tried to get a foreign army to put them in power was when they signed up with Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War. And so, if you remember that war from the 1980s, Saddam invaded Iran shortly after the Iranian Revolution, in part to take advantage of the sort of new government's lack of establishment and entrenchment. He thought that they were weak and there was an opportunity to take over, and so he invaded, and was just an absolutely catastrophic war for Iran. And so the decision of the MEK, which had been exiled at this point, to join up with the invader and fight Iranian troops destroyed their credibility in Iran.
Mm-hmm. And, that's sort of all important, that for the people in the United States who are being paid to advocate on their behalf, they keep saying things like, hey, this MEK group is the best hope we have for regime change, for democracy, for the future of Iran. Hook, line, and sinker, they are toeing the line that this is, you know, a plausible outcome whatsoever, that under any version of the regime change, that the people of Iran would ever tolerate being ruled by the MEK.
Yeah, it's really ludicrous. It's all so reminiscent of the Ahmed Chalabi fiasco in the Iran.
Well, at least, you know, his family had been bankrolling important Shiites in Iraq for a long time. He had some pull. He's still got an office there, right? He's somebody.
Well, so I guess that's more than zero.
Yeah.
People.
I mean, Chalabi was, yeah, Chalabi had like a 1% chance. These guys are...
Yeah, that's true. These guys might actually have less.
But yeah, I mean, they might just get lynched if we were to parachute them down into downtown Tehran, and never mind the cops. I mean, the people might just get them.
Oh, yeah. One of the things that I found kind of distressing was when I was doing interviews for my report when I was at the Rand Corporation, was speaking with some folks within the government who liked them. There were some folks in the government who liked them and a lot who did not. But those who did, they're just seen as just the convenience. And maybe they would provide some useful intelligence, and at the very least, they'd provide some bodies as bullet catchers. And I thought that was just extraordinarily callous, even to, you know, people who we don't necessarily respect.
Yeah, that sounds like the U.S. government talking. They're useful as bullet catchers. I think that'll be the title of this interview when I post it on the website.
I was appalled.
Well, so now... let's talk real quick here. We got about 3 minutes before we go out to break. There's and I want to get back to the legalities of all of those who provide material support to these terrorists in the United States and the politics of their listing or delisting and all of that. But can you tell us briefly here about the situation at Camp Ashraf? And is it true that there's a total breakdown in the cooperation by the MEK and their move from Ashraf to Camp Liberty and then out of the country before Maliki gets them?
Yeah, I don't have a great visibility on exactly what's going on. I mean, the MEK has been an extremely obstreperous group throughout all of the U.S.'s dealings with them in Iraq, and the fact that they even got this many people to leave and go to Camp Huria to be processed by a proper international legal process to see what other country they can go to. I found basically amazing. It was a real feat and of work by the State Department and their absolute stick-to-itiveness to deal with them. It's just really an extraordinarily difficult group to deal with. I'm not sure if they're what the dynamic is among the 1,000 or so people who remain at Camp Ashraf. If some of those people are ones who are leaders of the MEK and therefore would not benefit from the amnesty that Iran has offered to members of the MEK to return to Iran, where it is illegal to be a member of the MEK. But the proviso is members, but not leaders of the MEK, have amnesty to return so long as they cut ties with the group. And obviously the MEK leadership has no interest in having any of its people go back and cease ties with the group, or, of course, be actually prosecuted, which would happen to the leaders. So they probably cannot go back because they probably would not just be prosecuted, but also very likely persecuted because the Iranian regime does have quite a history of being brutal to members of the MEK.
Sure. Yeah. I wouldn't want to tangle with them, either side, really. now, whatever happened to Masoud Rajavi, the husband, is he dead?
The rumors are all around. He disappeared right around the time of the 2003 invasion.
Right.
People think he's dead. Sometimes you hear words of him appearing in Jordan. The MEK was trying to keep them believing he was alive by having rumors go around Camp Ashraf that he was paying cameo appearances.
Living at the Four Seasons in D.C., more likely. All right, we'll be right back after this. Jeremiah Golka, the American Prospect. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Jeremiah Golka. He wrote this, that one big, very important study of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq communist terrorist cult for the Rand Corporation. And now here he is at prospect.org, the American Prospect. with this article, The Cult of MEK, and they should have said, and their ties to prominent Democrats, but you can't get a title like that out of the American Prospect, but that's okay. And Republicans too. Clarence Page, I was surprised to see that you mentioned Clarence Page here, a Chicago Tribune columnist. I don't usually agree with him, but I'm surprised that he's dumb enough to just pocket some money and go give a speech in favor of a communist terrorist cult without Googling them first.
You know, it's interesting on that. Two quick points. One is rare among people who have spoken on behalf of the MEK. He says he's returned the money.
Really? Oh, that is good to say. Yeah.
Yeah, I have to give him that. And the second is if you Google the MEK, you find a lot of interesting things on them. I found that when I was when I started doing research on the MEK, that it took an enormous amount of effort to separate out information that seemed credible from what doesn't seem credible. The materials that they put out themselves and their supporters put out sound really appealing, and I think that's one reason why a lot of the various speakers who have spoken on their behalf, as well as members of Congress who are not getting, you know, direct paychecks, they, although I know at least in the past, before the MEK was listed as a foreign terrorist organization, they did receive some degree of campaign donations. The MEK does a great job of presenting themselves as being very pro-Western, pro-Western notions of democracy, women's rights, human rights. They sound very kind of cuddly. And if you don't try very hard, so it doesn't really take all that much effort, especially, you know, thanks to the growing awareness about the group that we've seen with various writers, not just me, about the reality of the group. Some people, particularly if they want to be willfully blind, could persuade themselves that this group is a good idea. And they certainly put on impressive shows and bring in lots of people, although, as some journalists have shown, not all of the people who come to their rallies are aware that it's about the MEK. Lots of people just think it's some sort of pro-democracy rally. And
well, they had one rally where it was homeless people bust in from Jersey.
Exactly, and they get church groups, and I think they get school groups in Europe of people who, you know, say they want to support democracy in Iran. And I mean, hey, who doesn't want to support democracy anywhere?
Now, when they're dropping $30,000, I guess I might give a speech for the MEK for $30,000. You know?
Well, so that's the interesting question. They give out that, and that's like per speech. And I just always found it curious that ex officials. Democrats and Republicans who are going to be able to have, I would assume, significant salaries. I mean, you think of someone like, you mentioned the Democrats, and so take ex-Governor Rendell of Pennsylvania. I mean, as someone who's an ex-governor, you would imagine that they're probably pulling down something like $1 million per year, which seems to be sort of an average ex-official type rate if you add up their various consulting gigs and board positions and lobbying jobs, whatnot. If you're making $1 million plus, why do you really need another $10,000 or $20,000? But, you know, we wonder what the price is of people to get bought. And, you know, if you're writers and radio commentators, I think that's pretty heavy money. But I always just wonder about folks who are looking at huge money, why they would be bought for what seems like relatively cheap for them.
Mm-hmm. And now, I'm actually not for this, except in this case. If you give me just a sec to explain, I'm not really a hypocrite. The courts say now, they have upheld, and I forget the name of the case, but they upheld the power of the government to prosecute and imprison people for speech. If they speak, and they don't even have to get paid for it. They just have to give a speech in favor of the bad guys. And here's the former director of the Department of Homeland Security abomination, and his top advisor, former governors, former Rudy Giuliani, and all of these people, they ought to be in prison. If nobodies with Muslim last names have to go to prison for making a YouTube, then these people have to go to prison for getting paid and pocketing money to speak on behalf of the Mujahideen-y cult, communist terrorist cult, which after all, killed American civilians and military personnel in Iran back in the 70s.
Exactly. This kid hits on this kind of wild sense of hypocrisy that you have Francis Fragos Townsend, who was the Homeland Security Advisor under Bush, supporting and saying it was a wonderful thing when the Supreme Court and Humanitarian Law Group versus Holder interpreted the material support statute as saying that not only did you have to, say, give money to a terrorist, a designated terrorist group for it to be a federal crime, but you merely, mere political speech would count if it was done while, you know, while working with the group. And here you have Townsend and others doing just that, speaking on behalf of this group at events organized by this group. And like you, I think that the Supreme Court decision is actually terrible. I think it's a total infringement on the First Amendment, but it is currently the law, and the idea of convicting people for things like YouTube or just saying things that should really just be cut under free speech, and then fining and imprisoning them, but then letting the big players get away with it and pocket significant sums of money. Just the hypocrisy is really nauseating.
Yeah. Well, so now I want to finish up asking you about just, if you can describe what you saw when you went to Camp Ashraf and all that. Real quick first, can you tell us, do you have a good idea about whether they actually will be delisted shortly? Does it all just hinge on what happens at Camp Ashraf?
I'm not sure what's going to happen. I think that a lot of people are wondering. The State Department has said that they will view leaving Camp Ashraf at they will see that as a favorable thing and make it more likely that they would the State Department would delist the group. The mere fact the state said that doesn't mean that they have to delist them. I think the likelihood is that they will remain listed, but I think that may possibly just be my hope more than anything else. And even saying it, I think it's 51% likelihood, maybe. I'm not sure. At some point, I'm going to write, fairly soon, I'm going to write my own piece on why I think that they should remain on the list. The State Department has to make their decision by October 1st, according to a court decision. And if they don't make the decision by then the court will automatically delist them.
Really? Oh, there you go. The pocket veto or whatever. Hillary Clinton gets to just let it happen, not
possible.
Stop it. I see.
Although coming, it'll be interesting. October 1st, right around the time of, a month before the election, and this does play into.
I think you just predicted the future right there with that explanation of the one possibility there. And of course, something being absolutely outrageous and criminal has never stopped Hillary Clinton. So,
Politicians are politicians.
Yep, afraid so. Well, I'm sorry, we have very little time, but, I'm always talking bad about these guys, as though they're a government, but they're not even a government. They're just a bunch of kooks. Most of them, probably denied protein for a year and got their kids kidnapped and are threatened and controlled and are basically helpless cult followers. I don't mean to be mean to them, specifically, but it just, I'm trying to discredit, our government's use of a terrorist cult group like that. But then I wonder, whether I'm right. Are they really that much of a Charles Manson type of kookery going on there or what?
Well, what I saw when I was at Camp Ashraf, and for starters, there are no children because they have mandatory celibacy. That they implemented after they did their own invasion of Iran at the end of the Iran-Iraq War. They said that their cult behavior started as essentially military-type activity in order to fight better. They said the reason that they didn't fight adequately well was that there was too much love in the trenches. So they mandated celibacy, forced divorce, no children. The children who remained were, who were born previously, were shipped out before the 1991 Gulf War. And it is it's a very strange place for people wearing their olive drab uniforms and with sort of dead looks in their eyes. Men and women don't touch. People cannot speak unless they're given permission to. There are different hours at the Camp Ashraf gas station for men and women. It is a, they have a strange, strange organization.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. We're all over time, and I got to let you go. But I really appreciate your time on the show, and I urge everybody to go and read this article at prospect.org, The Cult of MEK by Jeremiah Gulka. And if you really want the in-depth about Camp Ashraf there, go read his report at the RAND organization as well. Thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks so much for having me.